It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. The story of Chris McCandless went from being an oddball newspaper report about a starved young man found in an abandoned bus, becoming an Alaskan legend, bigger than Joe Reddington, bigger than Jack London, almost as big as Sarah Palin. But despite the many who idolize McCandless and see him as a modern-day Henry David Thoreau, some Alaskan critics see him as an unprepared fool who threw his life away and doesn't deserve to be seen as a hero. We're jumping into this debate with both feet today, with one of Alaska's most controversial and outspoken writers, Craig Medrid, and we're going to try to use it to tackle a deeper topic, the ethics of taking death-defying risks outdoors. And we hope you'll join us, because this is a unique edition of Outdoor Explorer. We're taking calls to have a lively community debate on both the rights and responsibilities of engaging in risky outdoor behavior. So thanks for being with us, Craig. I've waited for the right topic before inviting you. I'm glad you're here.
Well, thanks. Just while you were talking, I was thinking, you know, part of the problem here, and we didn't talk about this pre-error, but what McCandless did really isn't risky to me. I mean, it's not a hard trick. It's not that difficult to crush the tech. And if you get stuck, then Park Road is like an 8-hour hike to the south. It's not what I would think of as dangerous.
No, he wasn't very far out there, but he was very unprepared. And I was watching the movie. For those who don't know it, Chris McCandless, 1992, went out on the Stampede Road north of Denali National Park and hiked in and decided to live off the land without a hunting license or anything else.
But he did have 400 rounds of ammunition, which shows some thinking going in.
Didn't know what he was doing. I was actually watching the movie with my 13-year-old daughter, and as a movie starting and she's watching what's happening, she was saying, "This guy is an idiot." So I felt kind of proud of her. But in any event, he was unprepared. He went out, he made it for a while, and then something happened to him. He ended up starving, and it's controversial as to what happened to him. That was written about in a book called Into the Wild by John Krakauer, became a huge bestseller, and McCandless kind of became an idol. And then it was made into a big Hollywood film, which was actually a pretty good movie. And then there have been several other books written about him since, and he's sort of become a larger-than-life myth. But in terms of riskiness, it was risky for him because he didn't know what he was doing.
Well,
wouldn't be risky for you.
I think the most risky thing he did was eating the mushrooms.
Which
aren't in the Krakauer book, but in his journal, he writes many mushrooms, and in the photos he leaves are some very hallucinogenic mushrooms. And shortly after writing many mushrooms in his journal, he writes in the largest letters in the journal, "Dreams," with arrows connecting to the mushrooms. So he may have been enjoying those latter days of life in another kind of a parallel world while at the bus.
And Krakauer's theory was he was eating some seeds. And I know you have a lot of...
Krakauer's first theory was that he ate some potato seeds that poisoned him.
And I just want to let people know, I did invite Krakauer to be on today's show. And he declined through a publicist who said he was too busy. And I want to make sure people know something, which is that we are... normally we pre-record the show, but today we want to have a conversation. So we're on live with Craig Medrid.
So no bad language.
And the phone number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Out of Anchorage, it's 888, that's 888-353-5752. And email will come right to me here in the studio, outdoorexplorer@alaskapublic.org. Do you think the book was... just to get it off your chest, do you think the book was bogus at base, or do you think it just was inaccurate?
I went and fact-checked the book. We've got a story in the works, long story. There were certainly lots of things left out. There were certainly things people involved say they didn't say. The book certainly doesn't jive with what is recorded of the weather in that time. So, you know, I think John had some idea of the narrative he wanted, and you know, he got a little selective. How selective? I don't know. We all get, I mean, you know, you were a reporter. It's you take bits and pieces of a story and you build a whole story. So he took bits and pieces that best fit what he wanted to do, which was kind of comparing McCandless to himself, and got what he got.
Now, answer this for me. So listener is saying, well, wait a minute. Craig was around in 1992. He could have written the book. He could be the famous author. Maybe he just is feeling a little bit of envy that he didn't do it.
Not really. It was interesting. I would have liked to have had the time to go what he did and backtrack the rest of the McCandless story. And I, even in this exercise, I don't know how much of the McCandless picture he paints from outside is true or not, but it's an interesting, the guy's progression before he gets here is almost in many ways far more interesting to me in psychological terms than what he does here, which is only, you know, several months of his life up until the end. There's some odd behavior before, and I would love to kind of know how that started, why that was, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that was came through very clearly in the film, too, because the film's actually about him traveling around the country. It's kind of a good film, and the part in Alaska is really not that interesting.
Yeah, the traveling around the country part's interesting. I mean, abandoning his car, burying his money. I mean, there's just things I would never, or that you would never do, which, which kind of leave me, you know, what's going on in this guy's head?
I think that's what Peter wants to talk about. Peter, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Hey, Charles. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, Craig, this is Peter Porco.
I never would have guessed from that accent.
Well, you mentioned this whole psychological thing, and I want to bring up this bit that you had said about McCandless once, which you thought he was schizophrenic. But before that, I just want to read a limerick, which kind of tells me, which will tell you where I'm coming from. So, there once was a critic named Medrid. Fools in the wild, his big dread. McCandless, his demon, he hardly can see him, except as a nut who ended up dead.
Right. I think that's our first poetry call we've ever had.
I think Craig brings up a lot of great things with this whole business about people taking risks and the ethics and the business sponsorship of it. His column yesterday really went into that. But the whole bit, I thought Craig stepped way, way, way over the line when he said that McCandless exhibited the symptoms of onset
onset schizophrenia. I now think it's probably bipolar, but I'll ask you a question. Have you ever looked at the pictures in the family book?
Of his family book, no, but I did see a second movie.
Let me go on from there, because in the family book, among his pictures is a self-portrait he takes of himself with a dead porcupine in which he looks crazed. And the looking crazed to me says nothing, but the porcupine is the easiest animal to kill in the woods. I mean, it's powerless against a human. A 12-year-old can beat it to death with a stick. And I just, what is a person thinking when they pose with a trophy photo, you know, themselves and their trophy dead porcupine? I just...
Yeah, but he's a total greenhorn. He's never done anything like
that. But
this
is well into having killed lots of birds and squirrels and a moose.
I just say, if you're going to...
And everything. And I just... Why do you document that?
If you're going to do psychoanalysis on people based on their vacation photos, I think you could come up with a lot of crazy theories. But anyway...
Well, you can, but I mean, was the porcupine photo taken while he was at it?
His self-portrait. Okay. I mean, why do you take that photo? I mean...
I think there's pretty good evidence that McCandless, for quite a while of the time he was out there, was under some kind of duress, one sort or another. I mean, he was highly challenged. I think we all know that he didn't go in there with the skills that would have been necessary to survive in that environment. So having been so stressed and he's got nobody to turn to, I think maybe he went a little kind of nuts in there, as anybody would do. I mean, people under extreme duress will lose their minds. I mean, if you push them far enough.
That's true.
So I think that the notion that he had this kind of disease, I think it diminishes his motivation for going out there.
Yeah, but it also follows a pattern. I mean, there are people who abandon their families at that point in life and kind of, you know, reconnect, are kind of out of touch with civilization, in touch with civilization, or times appear brilliant to people who meet them. Those people often have mental issues.
Yeah. Okay, Peter, we're going to move on. Many of us, or maybe perhaps most of us, have some kind of mental issues.
I think it's widely undiagnosed in our society, and we really don't like to talk about it.
So here's a point that this move us on to another part of this discussion, which came to us through Facebook. Person who points out a lot of folks here in Alaska undertake far riskier adventures than McCandless.
Far riskier.
Perhaps some time spent with these individuals on the air would be less about beat the dead horse, who has lots of books, movies, and public commentary for examining this important topic and its relevance to Alaskans. In my defense, I'd say we've covered that topic a lot on the show and have had many adventures on the show. But I want to ask you this, Craig. Why did this become a larger-than-life myth? I mean, it almost doesn't matter what the facts are anymore. It's like deep into the American consciousness about Alaska and about the outdoors at this point.
Because it plays well with an urban society that sees the wilderness as both an Eden-esque place and an incredibly dangerous place. and it kind of captures that longing and that fear. Here's a guy who went there because it's this Eden-esque place, and it killed him. Mm-hmm. It is interesting that the losers get more attention than the successes.
I was going to mention Timothy Treadwell. He was the guy who spent time with bears in Southwest Alaska, got eaten by a bear, was on, before he was eaten,
but he had a lot of trouble getting that traction to get attention when he was successful. He made David Letterman once, but it was like a decade of work to get to that point where he finally got some attention. Once he died, he's famous everywhere.
Right. And again, it's kind of the same story if you watch the Werner Herzog movie, which is terrific, by the way.
Yeah. Timmy clearly had issues.
Yeah. He says, Timothy Treadwell thought nature was a kind person, but actually nature is a murderer. That was Herzog's interpretation.
And nature is a murderer. I mean, it's trying to kill all of us. None of us are going to live forever. That's what it sets out to do. I don't think it helps if you're not aware of that and not prepared for that.
Yeah. So we are taking calls today on Outdoor Explorer, talking about risk in the outdoors, talking about Chris McCandless and about sort of the broader issue of ethics of risk. The phone number here is 550-8433, 550-8433. Statewide, it's 888-353-5752, or email us at outdoorexplorer@alaskapublic.org. It seems to me that there's something quintessentially Alaskan about being 20 years old or so, going out and doing stuff that's dangerous when you don't really know what you're doing, surviving or not surviving, and I don't think anybody would say you shouldn't have a right to do that, but it probably doesn't make you a hero or someone to be admired if you do. What do you think, Craig? I mean, I would certainly never say people should be prevented from doing these things.
Well, I think it's how we all learn, and the lucky ones survive. I mean, in some respects, I've always wondered why we don't kill more people here in the wilderness than we do. It's an easy place to have things go wrong and die, and I don't think I know anybody who's spent a lot of time out there that hasn't had things go wrong, but, most of them learn from it. They get better, they get more skilled, they show better judgment, and they survive. So, I guess that's what makes McCandless an oddity. It's everyone scratching their head going, well, how could this have, what happened here? Well, why did he die on the Stampede Road? It's not... Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like a climbing accident on McKinley where it's pretty obvious that, you're operating with very thin margins and you fall and you die. And that's what happens when you operate in that environment. Here's a guy operating, you think he'd get out alive, and he doesn't. It gets him anyway. So, there's that kind of inherent mystery in it.
Right. And he wasn't a Henry David Thoreau. You were saying that he only wrote a few hundred words in his journal.
Yeah, his whole journal.
So everything else has been sort of projected upon him.
Everything's projected. His whole journal is less than 450 words. And most of those are like, dead squirrel or bird, or it's basically a log of what he was killing and eating. So there's very little to really put together a portrait of who the guy was.
And that, I guess, gives you gives one a free canvas upon which
gives
to imprint
one a free
your own
canvas
beliefs.
Which is kind of what John did in writing the book. He wanted this guy to be like himself, because the book is in large part about Krakauer, and he was kind of using McCandless as a parallel who didn't make it, as opposed to himself who made it, because we all go through what we were just talking about, that, you do this crazy stuff when you're young, and, he may have been a little too selective in what parts of McCandless he chose to put in there.
Successfully, because people are still writing books, and I guess McCandless' sister has just brought out another book talking about his troubled family. His parents had written a book. It goes on and on and on, and each with their own perspective, as if the sort of the psychology of this one 20-year-old is really the point.
I mean, there's also money in it now.
Right.
I mean, the books will sell, so, and you'll get attention for writing the books, and, what motivates people that's its own strange discussion as to, why people do things to get attention, which now, it didn't used to enter this world like it does now. Now the world's kind of crossed, because we have a lot of people in this world now taking big risks in the wilderness to shoot videos or movies to get attention,
right?
Which is, we've killed people that way too, and we'll probably kill more. And that's a whole new dynamic to this that, it kind of goes back to that, what you and I were talking about earlier before we went on the air about, he died doing what he loves. Well, You know, it doesn't make any, you know, it doesn't help your family any if you die doing what you love, and it probably helps them even less if it's captured on video.
Well, I think in terms of the ethics, which is our topic, I think that the ethics of sort of paying money to push people to do crazier and crazier stunts until they get killed, I think the ethical one on that is pretty clear.
It's a big ethical question.
Yeah.
And, you know, the problem is that almost all the people doing the stunts, if you talk to them, they buy into it, that, you know, I'm going to take whatever risks are necessary to do this, which is a little frightening. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, if you're an outdoor adventurer, there aren't a lot of ways to make a living being an outdoor adventurer.
Right.
So, you know, of course people are willing to take those risks. It's the way markets work. It's sad, but it's true.
And again, the ethics is different from law. Ethics is what you decide to do based on what's right and wrong. And we're not saying people shouldn't be allowed to do these things. We're saying that they shouldn't.
No, I would say if you have a kid who wants to do these things, tell them to join the National Guard and become a PJ, because they do all that crazy stuff and they train before they do it, which makes it a whole lot less crazy. But the crazy stuff they do is endless.
Well, I would not take anything, you know, and they're doing it for a good reason.
They're
right?
doing it for a good reason.
You are a hero if you do this stuff to help somebody else.
Yeah, you are a legitimate hero.
Yeah. Let's take Kenneth's call. You wanted to talk about Richard Pennicky?
Yeah, I just thought in contrast, if you point out Richard Pennicky,
no, I'm sorry.
Achievements and preparations and knowledge up in Twin Lakes in the Lake Clark National Park area back in the 1960s.
Yep.
My goodness, that was a man who was prepared, loved nature, and didn't put other people at risk when he did what he did and documented it
in a very
poetic fashion, I thought, in so many ways. I wish Hollywood had focused on him instead of this fellow who stumbled upon a bus.
He had preparation, he had knowledge, he had focus, he recorded it all. He's kind of like the anti-McCandless.
Exactly.
Well, you know, it seems to me that from the bigger culture, where you're talking to people who are from sort of an urbanized environment, most of the time the narratives they're interested in are about somebody who came from their point of view and went into the wilderness. So if you think about Farley Moe at Never Cry Wolf, I mean, he's a guy who's mm-hmm. going out there and he's learning about the environment, and you kind of identify with him because he goes out there not knowing too much to begin with. Even some of Jack London's greatest stories are about people who are going out and sort of having a hard time because they don't know what they're doing. Whereas if you have somebody who's really already an expert, I think maybe it's harder for a reader or viewer to identify with that person. And that may be one reason why somebody like McCandless, everybody can sort of remember being a confused 20-year-old. You know, what do you think, Kenneth?
Well, I suppose being a confused 20-year-old, but at the same time, Richard Pennicky at one point was a confused 20-year-old, but he made something of his life and left something behind that had, I think, much greater value.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, but it's harder to imprint your own vision of things upon that. I mean, I think, you know, part of this is that when you read Into the Wild, you can make almost anything out of McCandless you want. People seem to kind of gravitate to that as much as they gravitate to somebody or something that's purely defined. I know I talked to a lot of people in the last 5 years about Sarah Palin, and the people who are most fans of Sarah Palin are people who don't know her and have their own vision of Sarah Palin. I mean, it's like this canvas.
Yeah.
It's this canvas that's kind of vague, and in all the vague spots you can fill in around it with your own ideas. And I think that's what McCandless is kind of like. He's, mm-hmm. you know, you got kind of this, and you know it's not quite right, so then you can start filling in all the pieces, and then you can, you know, debate your friends about whether your version of the completed canvas looks like
then
theirs.
You defend it to the death, right. Here's Brian isn't talking to us driving, and he left this message with Monica, our producer. It says, having grown up in Alaska and being the same age as McCandless, the stories of Jacqueline and Robert Service to me portray a consistently harsh brutality of the wild and what it means to be out there on their own. I always thought McCandless was a glamorized fool. And I think Brian's comment points up the fact that McCandless makes a lot of Alaskans mad. I mean, it's not just that we think, whatever. People really get mad about this and about sort of the...
Well, he is glamorized, and I think you grow up with a unique perspective in Alaska. I mean, I think your kids, like my daughter, think that to die is failure. that, you know, that's just a given, that dying is failure. So we start with a real prejudice that this guy is a failure, and that kind of changes how you look at the whole thing from the start.
And if you're making mistakes is not, you know, not something to be.
Yeah, it's not, you know, making, especially a mistake of that, of the nature to kill yourself, is not something you'd be proud of. It's like, uh-oh.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
So, you know,
I want to talk, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about some of the columns that Craig has written about people who have made mistakes, which is one of the things that makes him a controversial figure in Anchorage. So stick with us, and if you want to get on the air with us, the phone lines are open, usually for Outdoor Explorer. Usually we pre-record, but this one we wanted to hear from you. If you're in Anchorage, you can reach us at 550-8433. If you're outside Anchorage, the number is 888-353-5752. It's been more than 20 years since Christopher McCandless shed all his worldly possessions and headed across the country on a soul-searching adventure. The 24-year-old's journey ended in Alaska, where he was found starved to death in an old city bus he used as a makeshift shelter in the interior. In a new book, McCandless' sister tells her story. Our producer, Monica Goki, has more.
The story of Christopher McCandless's fateful journey into the Alaska interior has seemingly been beaten to death. First, there was John Krakauer's best-selling book, Into the Wild, published in 1996. Then there was a hit movie produced by Sean Penn 10 years later.
What's the N stand for?
North.
Your great Alaskan adventure.
It's hard to say what exactly keeps us interested in this story. People routinely die in the Alaska outdoors. Tragic, definitely. But novel, not especially. Maybe it was McCandless's vagabonding across the U.S. that caught people's attention. Or maybe it was his philosophical journal entries. Either way, the story lives on, and now there's a new chapter. McCandless's younger sister, Corrine, with whom he corresponded regularly during his adventures, has recently come forward with a new book that delves into the McCandless family home life. In her words,
"From the beginning, I knew why Chris had embraced the harsh wilderness of Alaska, and why he had done it alone. But I wasn't ready to share with the rest of the world what had driven my brother to such extremes."
That clip came in a statement from Corrine's website. Her new memoir, called The Wild Truth, exposes a sometimes violent and abusive household. Earlier this week, she told Newsweek that she doesn't blame their parents for Chris's death, but she does hold them accountable for his disappearance. If you want to hear more on this story, PBS is releasing a special documentary next week retracing McCandless's footsteps. They promise new information and new interviews. You can watch it here in Alaska on KAKM, that's Channel 7, your local PBS station, at 8 o'clock next Tuesday, November 25th. That's 8 p.m. In Anchorage, I'm Monica Goki.
When you want more than you have, you think you need. When you think more than you want, your thoughts begin to bleed. I think I need to find a bigger place. 'Cause when you have more than you think, you need more space.
I have to say that Eddie Vedder's music is one of the best things to come out of the Chris McCandless story. You know, he wrote some great songs for that movie. We're back. We're listening to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Charles Wolforth, and we're talking about risk-taking in the wilderness. My guest today is Alaska Outdoors writer Craig Medrid from the Alaska Dispatch. And our phone lines are open today. If you're in Anchorage, you can call us at 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, toll-free, 1-888-353-5752. Or you can email us at outdoorexplorer@alaskapublic.org. Craig, you've written many times after there's been a mishap of some kind where someone's been killed outdoors or, you know, something's gone badly wrong. And you will sometimes write about the mistakes that person made. And sometimes you'll say, well, they didn't make a mistake. And some people think you've kind of set yourself up as a judge of outdoor ability and that maybe, you know, you shouldn't write about people who've just had a mishap or something bad's happened, just let them alone. Why do you do those columns?
Well, because we're human animals and we learn. We learn from experience. They connect with people. People think about it. I mean, we all make mistakes. The key to wilderness survival is not repeating them. And, you know, the best examples are those kinds of things. I don't know. You know, maybe I was trained as a scientist. I kind of like think about it like a scientist, that you learn from mistakes, that, you know, the scientific method is you float a hypothesis, and if it's wrong, you're happy. So that's kind of always been my attitude towards it. Some people don't like it. It is what it is.
Well, I had a guest in the studio on one of our recent shows who is a pretty impressive outdoors person who had done a lot, and asked, well, have you ever been in a big serious danger? And he said, yeah, and I always worry, oh my God, I could get killed and have Craig Medrid write a column about me. You know, so, I mean, you've really had an impact over the years.
Well,
I'll
confess, there have been more than an occasion I've thought about that in some really, really dicey situations and said, you know, if this goes south, how is this going to look?
Right. You know, and a lot of people say, oh, wait a minute, Craig.
Yeah, it's influenced my judgment. And, it, you know, and I, like everyone else, I've made some mistakes. And Lord knows the number of sketchy things I've done with some of my idiot friends that I wouldn't suggest anyone do. And if something bad had happened, we probably would have deserved it in retrospect. But, I mean, some of those were in places you just kind of had to get out of, so you do what you do.
So let's talk about that, how you evaluate risk. I mean, obviously, having some knowledge and experience, but then you still often, when it gets dicey, you have to make a call. You have to say, yeah, we can do this, or no, we can't. And you don't really know all the time whether the reason you got through a risky situation in the past was because it was safe or because you were lucky.
Well, you often get through based on luck. And I steadfastly believe that, you know, I don't know who first observed it, but I remember Dick Griffith telling me once that it's almost never the first mistake that gets you. There's usually a chain of mistakes that you make one mistake and then you make bad judgment trying to recover from that mistake, and pretty soon you're gone. But risk comes in various forms, and there's risks, you know, that something's going to go wrong and you're not going to get hurt, and there's risks that something's going to go wrong and you can get badly hurt quickly. And I often see that's where people don't, I mean, they engage in activities sometimes that really aren't that risky, but the consequences are huge. I mean, the risk mm-hmm. is small, but if you make a mistake, the consequences is just giant. So it's like, you know, if you're skiing a really steep couloir and you could fall, but the runout's good, well, that's one kind of risk. If you're skiing a really steep couloir and there's cliffs in there, and if you're going to fall and go over one of those cliffs, then it's like the consequences change. And that, you know, I think people don't recognize that often is where they get into problems is, you know, this may be what you did here may be as dangerous as what you do there, but what you do there has consequences far higher than what you did here if you make a mistake.
Right. So one of the things you need to do when you are in any outdoor situation that is potentially risky is you need to do kind of a decision tree analysis where you think about the different things that could happen, what the probability of them happening is, and how you would respond to them, and then see where that tree ends up. So if you have any kind of significant likelihood where you're going to be in a situation you can't handle, then you shouldn't do that particular activity.
Yeah, you know, and I think about it, there's really, I don't know if you remember, we had a couple snowshoers killed in Eagle River maybe 10 years ago in a place that it really wasn't, I mean, where they were hiking wasn't really risky, but above them was the risk, and the consequences of being where they were, which I don't think they fully understood, were really, you know, if something went wrong, the probability, which was low, but they were in a really bad place consequent-wise, and it avalanched far below them, and it buried them in a gully and killed them. And those are the kinds of things I think people are least likely to recognize, that, you know, although this isn't very risky, I mean, I'm going out on a day when avalanche conditions aren't that bad, and it looks okay, and I'm in the woods. It doesn't necessarily mean the consequences aren't great if something goes wrong.
Mm-hmm. When you write, I'm wondering when you're writing these columns, if you ever have the thought, you identify their mistake so that you can think, well, it wouldn't have been me. I wouldn't have made that mistake, and I'm going to be okay. And the reason I bring this up was you wrote a couple of columns about, no, I'm giving you the straight questions here, but you wrote a couple of columns about this guy who was killed on his bike tragically outside the Spinard post office uh-huh. there. And I think you wrote about it more than once about the fact that he didn't really do anything wrong and nobody else did anything wrong and he got killed anyway. And that seemed to be more disturbing to you than...
It is more disturbing. I mean, he made an error in judgment, but it's kind of error in judgment we'd all make that, you know, this is the way traffic's moving, is safe for me to cross. And he got slowed down a little and somebody wasn't moving at the speed he thought they were moving at, and whammo. You don't get much of a... you know, if you're on a bike in traffic, the margins are really small. I mean, it's another one of those things of the risk, you know, the risk of crossing the street there wasn't that big. The consequences, huge. And that's, you know, it's kind of illustrated what we were just talking about. So those kind of, you know, those mistakes that all of us could make, those trouble me more than any.
Yeah.
I mean, the easy mistakes to make are a little.
Because you don't want to think about the risk. I mean, you are taking an inherent risk anytime you do anything outdoors.
Yeah. And you know,
no matter how good you are.
In many cases, we're better as humans at evaluating the real obvious big risks than the little risks. You know, I've been pack rafting and you're going to hit a big stretch of white water you've never seen before. You get out, you hike the whole thing, you know, you may get yourself all psyched out. You're kind of like, you know, freaked out before you started. I mean, so you're really kind of approaching it in the most cautious manner. But things with small risks are, you don't do that. You don't go, okay, well, it's not that dangerous. What happens if?
Well, what about this, and I'm embarrassed, I can't remember his name, but there was a Wilderness Classic competitor.
Rob Kerr.
Yeah, who was killed in his packraft, just as you're saying. And everybody who talked about it said, well, this guy knew what he was doing.
He knew what he was doing. He had a little fear of water. We always, you know, it's really cut close to home because Rob used to manage the Rainy Pass checkpoint for Iditarod Invitational. Mm-hmm. And we on many occasions sat around and talked about Wilderness Classic and how eventually someone's going to make a mistake and die. And, you know, it's an inherently dangerous race, in part because people are going without much sleep, and your judgment gets fogged by that. And Rob was really always pretty conservative with his paddling because he wasn't the strongest boater. And I, you know, they probably put in one rapid too high for him, and he got really unlucky. And it's just really, really sad. That one cut really close to home.
Well, what do you think of that, the idea of a race where you're pretty sure that somebody's eventually going to die? That seems... I don't know. We're getting into ethics again, but
we're getting into ethics again. I've done the race. I know some of the racers are good friends of mine. I think I'd have real problems if the race involved any real fame or money. But given it's just a bunch of Alaska guys kind of going, you know, who can beat who to point X, I don't think the race entices anyone to take any chances they wouldn't normally take.
Oh, I don't know, because I mean, I've had Roman in here a number of times, Roman Dial.
Well, Roman takes a lot of risks.
He takes a lot of chances on his own. He doesn't need to be enticed. But there's also sort of, and I'm not talking about Roman now, maybe I'm talking about you, is there's this macho thing of like, who's the toughest Alaskan, right?
And well, I think you're talking about Roman.
Yeah, okay, I'm talking about Roman too. And I'm talking about Dick Griffith, too. I mean, there's sort of like, you are the ultra-tough guy who can do it, whoever you are. And you want to be tougher than anybody else, and that's a drive that's as real as wanting to make that Hollywood buck. Yes.
Yeah. No. It's very borderline, and there's been a lot of people, you know, talking about it ever since Rob died, and you know, what's the future of the Wilderness Classic, and should we kill this thing? And you know, I would say no. I don't think it crosses the line, but boy, it's right up against it. You know, if the winner was getting $1 million, I'd have a real problem.
Mm-hmm.
If there were a big prize that caused people to take risks even bigger than they would take, I would have a real problem with that. I mean, if they were getting $10,000, I'd probably have a problem with that. It you know, as we saw, we've seen in Iditarod, people will take certain risks that they wouldn't otherwise take when there's, you know, big reward at the end.
There's a big safety net under the Iditarod these days.
There's a huge safety net in the Iditarod these days, in part because I think they recognized, you know, the enticement of winning and the prize money and whatnot. There's a much bigger, I mean, that race has really changed since I first covered it. There's a huge safety net now.
In terms of the way you, sort of the ethics of risk, I think most people would feel there's a different ethic if you've got a young family at home, and I've known guys who went out and got killed doing really pretty stupid stuff and left a wife and little kids at home, and you really, when that happens, you don't just feel sad, you feel angry at that person, that was not something they had a right to do. How did your sort of life situation change the way you address risk as you've gone through your experiences?
I don't think that I tried telemarking the ptarmigan North Kuwa after Katie was born, and I don't think I'd ever do something that insane again, but it does... I mean, kids change, you know, if you're an adult, at least kids change the way you think about it. Man, I know guys who've had kids and certainly, you know, didn't think about it at all. But, you know, I think most thoughtful people, they moderate their behavior. And And kind of going the other way, I probably shouldn't confess this on radio, but when my daughter blew out her ACL, it was kind of like a happy day for me, because her career choice in life up until that point was to be a big mountain snowboarder, which is a good way to get smacked. And she got more conservative after that. I mean, it was a wake-up call that our bodies will break. And I think part of that, being injured, being beat up, having close calls, those things make a big impression too. But kids really change it.
And what about when she left home? Did you feel like, well, I can go out and take more risks again? Or did you sort of reach an age at that point where you didn't want to anymore?
Well, I still go out and take risks pretty regularly. I don't know how to gauge that, but we do have a rule on, how many days I have to be gone before anybody's to be notified. And then it's pretty selective as to who's to be notified. So, that in and of itself is a risk. I wouldn't suggest most people do that. Tell your mate, your loved one, your friends, whatever, if you're not back by the next morning to get somebody looking for you. But our rules are a little different. So that's a risk that, most people don't think about. I mean, I wouldn't encourage most people to take off on a snow machine up the Iditarod Trail to Nome by themselves. And I've done it. I met other people out there doing it. It was no problem. It's not a big challenge. But, with all these things, it depends on your skill set. It depends on how comfortable you are, and that's how used to it you are. I mean, yeah. if it's a natural environment, then you're very comfortable. If it's an unnatural environment, then it's suddenly a whole... scary places are scary, and it makes it harder to function.
Do you seriously think to yourself, is this risk worth what I would put, my loved ones through if I didn't make it back?
I mainly just think about making it back now. I mean, I admit I'm kind of like, okay, what are the consequences here if we do this? Is this really worth it? And I think I'm more prone as I'm aged to say, I'm not going to do that. I run almost every day in the park. Years ago, I never would have thought about carrying bear spray. Now I kind of always just put it in my hand instinctively, thinking it's better to have it and not need it than to need it and not have it.
And your guy has been bit by a bear.
Yeah, I just never, and I don't worry about it a lot, but I just kind of take it because, you could use it. And I've had a couple incidents the last couple of years with young bears that just wanted to, kind of challenge you and push you around. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of comforting to have it there and go, I can spray them if I want and teach them a lesson.
Well, we mentioned Dick Griffith, and he was on the show and said that when he did these Arctic traverses, he could have taken a sat phone, but he didn't. And I said, well, why not? He said, because if I was in trouble, I might call somebody. Which is sort of one whole end of the spectrum. Do you take some kind of communications?
I don't, and I was opponent to the. I was one of the people who opposed the Wilderness Classic requiring sat phones, and I kind of stayed semi opposed right up until the point John Lapkus, who I think has done just about every one of them. I don't know if you know John; he's a local doctor. He had some internal bleeding while out there and called for a rescue. And he, if it hadn't been for a sat phone, would have died. So. After that, I kind of gave in and said, yeah, everybody taking a sat phone is good. But there is that, as Dick mentioned, it's very tempting, and especially for inexperienced people. We get a lot of rescues now called in by people who really just are uncomfortable.
It's, right.
We're really suffering out here. Come and get us. And every time you do that, you put rescuers at risk.
Yeah, that'll be a good topic for our next session. We're going to take a break here and then come back. And when we come back, I'll be giving the phone numbers. If you want to get your thoughts in on risk-taking in the outdoors, what kind of risks do you think are okay to take? Is it really totally in the judgment of the person doing it, or is there a little bit of a responsibility to come back alive and not put others at risk to rescue you and not put your family members and the people who have invested in you? We get people who talk about it's an addiction. Well... what's the responsibility that goes with that? And it's an interesting conversation, so we'd love to hear from you. I'll give those numbers out in a little while. But first, the story you're about to hear comes to us from APRN reporter Annie Feit. A couple of years ago, she visited Denali during climbing season to get a sense of what kind of risk-taking the park rangers were seeing on North America's tallest mountain. Here's what she found.
It It's the kind of day climbers call severe clear in Talkeetna. But John Evans isn't focused on Denali looming above the town. He's concentrating on his last latte for the next several weeks.
Yeah, you want a hand?
Huh?
Do you want a hand?
Do I want a hand? Do you know how to pull shots?
No.
Oh, well,
Evans is part of a team of 10 British climbers with the Royal Army. They're preparing to climb Denali as part of a military training exercise, but also for fun. He says he enjoys the risks of mountaineering.
Puts a bit of sparkle in your life, I suppose.
But he also likes the challenge of minimizing those risks.
I think everything's got an inherent risk, hasn't it? You know, crossing the road's got an inherent risk. It's just how you manage that risk. So even if you spent 2 years planning it, if it means you can't get to the top, but you will get down, then that's what happens. You come down with all your fingers and toes, and everybody's still walking.
That's the kind of thing Daryl Miller likes to hear. He's the lead ranger at Denali, and he's spent over 25 years on the mountain as a climber, guide, and ranger.
We're pretty straightforward with people. We care, we're compassionate, but we also feel that when you're in the mountains, you're on your own.
Miller's number one priority this time of year is getting climbers up and down Denali safely. For the most part, he succeeds. Each year, rangers have to rescue only 10 to 20 climbers.
On Denali, there's no correlation with inexperience and experience and who has the accidents and who dies.
One of the leading causes of accidents is dehydration. It sounds like a small thing, but Miller says small mistakes lead to bigger ones. And he says nothing is easy on Denali.
For people to drink 3 or 4 quarts of water a day, that means that you're going to have to melt a lot of snow. So you're going to have to spend several hours a day plus melting snow. So going on the mountain and trying to stay hydrated, it's really hard.
Miller and his team of rangers work hard to make sure climbers understand what they're getting into. But that can be a tough job. Nearly half of the climbers are foreign, many with limited English skills, like this group checking in from France.
You know what I want? Are you all from the same area in France or different places?
No, same. Part of the same area.
Okay. Well, will one of you take one of these pins and put it in our map of the world over there above the copy machine, please?
Each team goes through an hour-long orientation on what to expect on Denali. Mountaineering ranger Meg Perdue leads the French climbers through the briefing.
At 11 camp, there's some big crevasses that go right under this camp, so be aware of that, and it's a good idea to rope up.
Perdue has been a ranger on the mountain since 1999, and she says her attitude towards risk has changed over time.
I've become much more accepting of the notion that people just have different levels of acceptable risk. And that's okay.
But Perdue says it can be frustrating to stand back and watch climbers make poor decisions, knowing she may have to respond if things go bad. Occasionally, she decides to step in. In one memorable incident, she encountered a husband and wife leading their 12-year-old daughter on the upper mountain. The parents wanted her to become the youngest climber to summit Denali. But Perdue says the girl did not look good.
Her level of consciousness, like her mental status, was somewhat compromised. She was kind of in a heap and sitting down on a pack, and they were trying to get her going to keep her moving to the summit. And you know, I just looked at that and I said, you have to go down. And they argued with me.
The family did eventually agree to go down, and the girl was fine. The bottom line for lead ranger Daryl Miller is that most accidents on Denali are preventable.
I always tell people, and it's not my saying, but the lightest thing in your backpack is your judgment.
He also wants climbers to take a healthy amount of fear with them up the mountain and to recognize that when they put themselves in harm's way, they take their family along with them.
I call it the chain of pain. And when the climbers are gone, it's the people afterwards that bear that torch, and many of them never get over it because most of the time, climbers die before their time.
Miller says when he's recovering a body, he thinks about a quote from British climber Edward Whymper, hanging on the wall at the Talkeetna Ranger Station. Do nothing in haste, look well to each step, and from the beginning, think what may be the end. In Talkeetna, I'm Annie Feit.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Charles Woolforth, and today we're talking about the ethics of risk-taking in the wilderness. In the studio with me is Alaska Outdoors writer Craig Medrid from the Alaska Dispatch News. And we have another 15 minutes here to talk about our subject, including the Chris McCandless story. Our phone lines are open, and it's an unusual thing on this show. We usually pre-record, but we wanted to add your voices and your thoughts on risk-taking. And do you resent it when other people tell you not to take risks or act like it's unethical to take risks? Or do you resent it when people who take risks, essentially doing their vacation hobby, are held up as heroes? Two ways of looking at this. Our phone lines are open, as I said, and the number in Anchorage is 550-8433, 550-8433. Out of town, it's toll-free, 1-888-353-5752. And you can reach us at email at outdoorexplorer@alaskapublic.org. So topic of risk and who has a right to do it gets to a certain extreme, Craig, when you think about extreme skiers who are doing activities, and others who are doing activities essentially because they're adrenaline junkies. And I've had them on my show who admit that really it's not about judgment. It's about the fact they need a fix. When I go outdoors, I want to go where I want to go, and I want to minimize the risk. But there are people out there who want to maximize the risk.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's not just extreme skiers. I mean, there have been any number of our Alaska bear people that way who just wanted to get close to bears because they really got a thrill out of the danger of getting close to bears. You know, I know some pack rafters like that. There have been a lot of whitewater rafters like that. Andy Embeck, who committed suicide eventually, you know, was one of the state's best paddlers, had that going on. I mean, a part of it was that. He needed that juice from the scare of near miss.
Mm-hmm. And there's a thing people say, that he died doing what he loved, which we're not talking about Embeck there, but I mean... Yeah, but you could also say that about a heroin addict. I mean, that, you know, and it's not necessarily something that you want to encourage, you know, that it's it maybe it's not a good thing. Maybe it impairs your judgment to really crave that.
Well,
kind of
it doesn't help their families much. I mean, your mm-hmm. family's still got to live with it. I mean, it's, I don't know. I have a one-time good old friend named Jerry Austin, who was quite the Iditarod musher and had a serious drinking problem. And the doctors told him that, you know, if he didn't quit drinking, it was going to ruin his liver and kill him. And he just said, I'd rather die. And he drank himself to death.
Yeah.
You know, which he died doing what he'd come to like. But, you know, it's horrible for families that get left behind.
Doesn't mean you should emulate it. Yeah. So, we lost that caller. Let's go to Wade, who's calling about a topic that I think you've written about, Craig. Wade?
Hi, Charles. Good to be on the air. I just wanted to see what kind of perspective you have. I don't know if you've heard recently, Alex Honnold and several other climbers who are known for free soloing on big walls were dropped by Cliff Bar specifically because they believe that at Cliff Bar that it's too risky to be taking the sport in that direction. And I read Alex Honnold's response piece in the New York Times recently, and I think that, you know, he had a lot of good points, that it's a very personal thing that he climbs for himself, and that, you know, it's Cliff Bar's right to kind of sponsor in the direction that they want things to be going. But I just wanted to see what your perspective on that would be.
Yeah, I read, Craig wrote a column about this, and I kind of agreed with Craig that the sponsors do need to take some responsibility for what they're sponsoring. And I've spoken to, you know, adventure filmmakers who said, you know, as careful as they want to be and as careful as they want to talk about being, there's no question that there's a competitive push to take things to the next level. And I think to my mind, if you're a sponsor, you know, and you want to get the positive out of the amazing feats of these athletes, you better also be willing to take the responsibility of the negative. That is, that you are potentially contributing to a lot of danger.
And that was the most interesting part to me of the New York Times story on it, was that Cliff Bar didn't comment. And it really kind of makes me wonder, you know, if the risk managers were involved and if some risk manager said, okay, you know, this is getting close to the point where a bad accident could happen. And what's our downside if that happens?
Right. Yeah. That struck me as for some of these Red Bull events as well. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. What are their, you know, there's the brand thing. Like, maybe it's good for their brand for people to get killed. But then surely there's some liability if you push people to that kind of level. I don't know.
And that went on with Red Bull when we had a snow machiner killed, if you remember, that they had kind of not said anything. And then all of a sudden they started talking about safety and safety plans.
And it was a young person, as I recall.
It's a mixed bag for a company to, you know, back someone engaged in truly risky sports. I mean, it's much better to back someone who's engaged what look like risky sports, but really aren't that risky.
Yeah. Yeah, good question,
well,
Wade.
I think when it comes to climbing, you know, there's definitely an aspect that we're much more a sport that is based on personal accomplishment. You know, it's kind of changing recently, but in the past, it's always just been something that you do because you love it. And so I think it'll be interesting to see how kind of sponsorships evolve in the future.
Well, skiing's
becoming a much more popular sport.
Yeah, well, skiing's the same way. I mean, there's a number of those sports, from skiing to kayaking to, you know, pack rafting for that matter, that people kind of just did for fun, and now there are people involved are trying to figure out how to monetize it, as we say in the digital world where I now work. And that's where you get into all these sponsorship arrangements and, you know, what do you produce for sponsors, and about all you've got to do to produce for sponsors is something that's visible. Mm-hmm. And to get visible these days, it, you know, you really got to kind of keep upping the bar.
We're going to move on to another caller because we're running out of time. But thanks, Wade. That was a good question. Jerry, Jerry, you wanted to talk about a topic that Craig and I were talking about during the break, which is the risk for rescuers.
Well, good afternoon to both. Great topic. I haven't seen you for a while, Craig. How are you?
Good.
It becomes a kind of a cultural moire or cultural ethics issue because we will respond to a call for help in almost any circumstance. And the people who become either victims or those that get rescued, it seems they don't understand that deep enough in our world that they're not just putting themselves at risk. It's a whole train and group of people behind them that they're putting at risk. And there's some very classy examples in this state, including, the crash of Gila 1 a while back, that it somehow has to be part of an educational system, that you're not an isolated entity, even in the backcountry. Craig and I have talked about this, and it's a hard one to convey to people. It's a hard one to educate people that we won't let people alone. There are no such things as a no-rescue zone, even in Alaska.
Yeah, that's true.
No, but, you know, we do have some people now who have done what I know a certain chief Chugach State Park ranger named Jerry Lewansky did, was tell people they weren't getting rescued because they weren't in enough trouble yet. And we've seen that on McKinley a couple times. Now, McKinley rangers have said, you know, to people that, you know, you're not in that much trouble. We're not putting rescuers at risk to come and get you. You're going to have to sit there until the weather changes or conditions improve or... You know, and that is another societal question of, you know, the Gila 1 really raised that to me. I mean, given the weather conditions, Carl Oberg could have stayed out there overnight and lived, and they instead decided they had to rescue him, and it just turned out tragically for everyone.
Yeah, and you wrote some pretty good stuff on that as well. Thanks, Jerry. I want to go now to another caller, Daryl, who had a point about communication. Daryl?
Yeah, hi, this is Daryl Miller, and I would say it's a responsible act to take communication into the wilderness. It's an irresponsible act to base your risk on communication.
So in other words, it's irresponsible to not take communication that people are looking for you, right?
Yeah, as a rescuer, that's how I looked at it. And then also, my point line for the rescue part of it is, your emergency may not be our emergency. And the bottom line there, when you look at emergencies, rescue or safety will trump everything.
I hope so.
Well, you hope so, but we Hilo 1 proved that isn't always the case. I mean, that has to be, you know, it's interesting. The Life Med pilots, they're not told what the mission is. Simply to avoid their thinking that, you know, it's life-threatening. That they're just told, we need you to fly here, you know, plot out this flight, come back, tell us if you can do it. Which might be something troopers should think about in the future.
Well, doesn't Alaska Mountain Rescue, those guys are pretty much volunteers who are there making their own judgments, and they take some pretty substantial risk to get to people. And is there really, I don't know, you guys can tell me, is there somebody telling them don't do this rescue?
Should be. Should be a rescue coordinator with troopers telling Alaska Mountain Rescue, and certainly if they're involved with the park, Daryl, correct me if you're wrong, but if you use any volunteers, they stay under your command of the ranger in charge, correct?
Absolutely. And also, you have an incident commander. And typically at Denali, you'll have three or four keys to the helicopter. So you have an incident commander, you'll have several other people that are being briefed about whether you fly or not fly. And typically, we have a go-no-go, so we have to have more than a mile of visibility. You have to have less than 30 knots crosswinds. All these things come up, and then you decide whether or not you're going to do the mission.
But we've lost rescue rangers on McKinley, have we not?
And
it strikes me that, I mean, this to me goes back to the climber. You know, you don't have to climb Mount McKinley. I mean, it's a great thing to do, you know, and it'll be a good feather in your cap, and you'll probably feel good about it. But you don't have to climb it, and just by virtue of the fact you're doing it, you're actually putting other people at risk because you might need rescue, and you might not do anything wrong and still need to be rescued. I don't know. That's probably the last question of the show, but I'll throw that open to both of you guys.
Well, I've been rescued by the people I was with, and I've rescued people, most of them the people I was with, but not all of them. I mean, there is some individual responsibility here, but we're a country that's big on talking about individual responsibility until it comes to each of us. Then it all changes at times.
I mean, it seems to me like the Park Service must look at that and think, you know, how did we, you know, obviously you don't want unqualified people up there, and we're essentially out of time, so we're leaving everybody with a good question to think about, but it's a good topic, and I thank you for calling, Daryl. I guess I really don't have time to ask you another question. And thank you for being with me, Craig, and it's obviously a conversation that could go on for a really long time. It's a basic Alaskan question, and Chris McCandless is such a funny person to end up being the symbolic of it when you think of all the amazing people who do stuff here.
Yeah,
in Alaska.
A guy who didn't take much risk, and it starts a risk discussion.
There you go. So Craig has been with us. Craig Medrid, Alaska Dispatch News outdoor writer and columnist. Outdoor Explorers off next week for Thanksgiving, but we'll be back December 4th. We have a show for you on small game hunting, which I think is going to be quite interesting. If you want to hear more about the Chris McCandless story, there's a new PBS documentary airing next week that promises some new information. That'll be on KAKM Channel 7, our local PBS station, on Tuesday, November 25th at 8 p.m. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Grace Bogine is our production assistant. Monica Goki is our producer. I'm your host, Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.